Hey everybody, Sam here. We've got some great news to share and also a favor to ask. We're in the running for this year's People's Choice Podcast Awards in both the People's Choice and Technology categories, and we would really appreciate your support. To nominate us, you'll just head over to twimlai.com/nominate, where we've linked to and embedded the nomination form from the award site. There, you'll need to input your information and create a listener nomination account. Once you get to the ballot, just find and select This Week in Machine Learning and AI on the nomination list for both the Adam Curry People's Choice Award and the This Week in Tech Technology category. As you know, we really, really appreciate each listener and would love to share in this accomplishment with you. Remember, that URL is twimlai.com/nominate. Feel free to hit pause and take a moment to nominate us now. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. A quick update about the upcoming Twimmel online meetup. On Tuesday, July 17th at 5 p.m. Pacific time, Nick Teague will lead a discussion on the paper Quantum Machine Learning by Jacob Biamonte et al., which explores how to devise and implement concrete quantum software for machine learning tasks. If you haven't joined our meetup yet, visit twimlai.com/meetup to do so. In this episode, I'm joined by Alexander Chukovsky, Director of Data Services at Munich, Germany-based career platform Expertier. In this podcast, we explore Alex's journey to implement machine learning at Expertier. In particular, Alex and I discussed the Expertier NLP pipeline and how it's evolved over time to address the company's need for greater automation in the way it processes jobs on its platform. We also discuss Alex's work with deep learning-based NLP models, including models like VDCNN and Facebook's FastText offering, which he's particularly excited about. Finally, we briefly touch on some recent papers that look at transfer learning for NLP, how Alex keeps up with academic papers in general, and a few tips for people looking to inject ML and DL into their products or projects. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone, I am on the line with Alex Chukovsky. Alex is Director of Data Services at Expertier. Alex, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Hi, Sam. Thank you for having me. Great to be on the show.
So why don't we get started by having you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into machine learning and data science. You come at it from the business angle, which is kind of an interesting starting place, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So I studied economics, majored in finance and statistics in the beautiful city of Munich. And then until 2014, I used to manage a data processing team at Expertier, which I'll tell you what the company does. And the data processing team was like a very large entity of the company. It's like the core team. It had about 100 people doing all kinds of stuff related to processing job data in 12 different markets, 7 different languages. So quite a lot of complexity. And my role was to kind of manage the team, put a direction on it, make sure that everything runs smooth and efficient, that the quality is good. To develop some new web-based tool, because our whole data processing stack was a Ruby on Rails application developed internally. And I kind of got into machine learning by chance. So back in 2014, beginning of 2014, we had like a local optimum of efficiency. So we had very high cost per job, which was like our internal KPI, and we were looking at options of how to drive this cost down. So pretty much all the operational projects that we could do to improve this were done. Technologically speaking, the platform was very streamlined. So somehow someone came with the idea to use support vector machines to kind of assist the classification process of the jobs, which is like the part that takes a lot of time. And we had a very first implementation that did not really work out very well. It was not taken very well by the team. And then, but still kind of interesting results. So the management and I kind of said, okay, let's look at what this machine learning thing can do. So we did not have any capacity internally, so no one was actually familiar with machine learning in the company. So we talked to a few external agencies to kind of get competency from outside and help us to build one of the first prototypes that we used in the beginning. So more or less, I really come from the business side, and I got into machine learning by chance, so to say.
It may help folks contextualize some of what you described by digging into Expertise and what the company does and what some of the main problems that you've been tasked to solve there are.
Yeah. All right. So Expertise is a closed career platform for high paid professionals, which means that the jobs that are offered on this platform have a very high salary. So they start at above 60,000 euros or about $100,000 in the US. And it's a closed network where recruiters can contact candidates. And the reason why Expertise has been so good at solving this problem of offering jobs to candidates is because we have a very extensive job classification, right? So if you go on a typical job board today and you would search for a job, so let's say I would go to one of the large job boards and I would search for a CEO position, and everyone can do this experiment, I would most likely get all kinds of jobs that have a direct text match that has something to do with reporting to the CEO or assistant to the CEO, and maybe somewhere in the fifth or in the sixth result page, I would get like a job that really matches. So that's kind of the problem of traditional job search, the full text search. And Expertise solved this by adding a few additional layers on the search side. So for example, we would have something called a career level, right, where we would put jobs in different categories, like a job for someone who is out of university or a job that is for someone who leads projects or for someone who manages teams or manages managers that manages teams and so on. So you would be able to use these filters and kind of dig really deep into finding a job that is really interesting for you on the one hand. But on the other hand, if you set up your profile correctly, you would get suggestions that are very relevant for you. So Expertise has a very detailed job taxonomy, classification of jobs. So for example, the industries, we have about 630 industries. So if you're looking for a job in consulting or in risk and restructuring consulting, we have it. It's there and we can offer it to you, right? So this is kind of the problem that the team was trying to solve. So putting jobs in these extensive categories, right?
And are the jobs, the listings sourced from public postings, or are they sourced privately proprietary listings that can be? And the question is really, how much noise is in those listings, or are they, if you're sourcing them privately, are they cleaner than you might expect from just a crawled set of listings?
Yeah, that's a good question. So back when we started in 2014, everything was very clean because we had kind of automated this whole crawling process. It was still not completely automatic, so people still had to trigger them, but the content of the job, so the job text, was very clean. A little bit later, once we kind of started crawling on large scale, another problem came where we would have text that is not related to the job. So back when we were building this first iteration of the solution, we had fairly clean job descriptions, I would say.
You kind of had this point in the business where you know, things were going okay, but you needed to figure out a way to kind of make the next leap in productivity. And you came across machine learning as a possible opportunity. Like, and you said it didn't necessarily work, but it was promising enough that you continued to invest in it. Like, what did you do then? What was the next step?
Yeah, so the next step was, first of all, of course, convinced management that there is an opportunity there. So we came up with a very motivational goal for the team. So we would like to cut our costs by 50%. And at the same time, increase the output by a factor of two, the team output. And as I mentioned in the beginning, because we didn't have any competency, we kind of talked to a few external agencies. We gave them data sets, and they were, so to say, in a competition of showing us who can do better. And one of the agencies got quite all right results. So we said, okay, let's give it a go. I mean, the cost perspective was okay, so there was nothing to lose. And we decided to start working with them.
And what even gave you the confidence to put that kind of an aggressive goal on the table after an experiment that, you know, didn't necessarily prove out, you know, that you can do it? It sounds like it wasn't a foregone conclusion that you'd be successful when you threw that out on the table.
So this goal came mostly from our CEO. So I guess that from his experience of being a business leader, he had to set very high goals to motivate people like me and the other people in the team. Yeah, I mean, the initial results were not really satisfying, but they were still kind of interesting. So we saw that the support vector machines, even though they only took the job title and a part of the text, kind of got a few of the functions of the jobs correctly. So we said, okay, you know, we need a large goal here. So it's either go big or go home. And I think from a purely psychological perspective, if you have such a huge goal, you know, you're not chasing the next 10%. It's kind of more motivating. That's for me. And this is how I would do it if I were to implement some kind of a new machine learning process in a company that's going to change completely the paradigms. I would really set high goals.
How did the process kind of evolve over time with this? You know, what were the steps, I guess, to achieving that goal? Did you achieve that goal? And what were the steps to getting there?
Yeah, so so in order to keep people interested, yeah, we did achieve the goal. we got our cost curve down to 30% from what the baseline was when we started. So this is like a 70% saving. Mm-hmm. But the most interesting part was that we tripled the amount of jobs that we had on the platform back then. And for a lot of people, this probably doesn't sound like a lot to triple the content of jobs. But as I mentioned in the beginning, Expert here focuses on these high-level jobs, right? So jobs above $100,000. And if you look at an average page of a company that has 1,000 jobs, maybe 5% of them would be relevant for this type of market. So getting to tripling the amount of jobs that we had on the platform, we actually had to increase our processing power. So the amount of jobs that we pushed through the platform, we call it assembly line. So if the team used to be able to do like manually about 50, maybe 60,000 jobs a month, today we process close to 3 million every day. So you can like imagine the gains that we had.
Yeah, that's a huge difference.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah.
And so there was a significant part of the workflow previously that was based on manual categorization, and that's all, or some portion of, some large portion of that, it sounds like, has been replaced with machine categorization?
Yeah, this is correct. So this was, so we kind of drew a picture of our complete value chain, like from how a job comes to the platform every step that it needs to go through before it's like finished and processed to be served to a customer. And we identified which are the areas that took most of the time. And I mean, it was not surprising, but the classification was like the biggest one. So that's where we started. So if I look at the way the team has evolved today, it's mostly the work is now kind of quality related work. So there is very little classification going on, maybe for jobs where the model is still not very sure about the classification that it provides.
And so how many iterations of your pipeline have you gone through at this point? Did you kind of settle in on the whatever the first thing you did with the winning consulting company after you set out on this path, or have you iterated your pipeline a few times?
I would say that up until, I mean, also including today, we are constantly iterating. So we started with, if you think about our data pipe, it had in the beginning four services, the four classification services. So today we have close to 30 different services that are related to these data processing steps. So not all of them are machine learning based, but I would say probably half of them are. So the way we started was that the agency was like very optimistic. They were great guys based in Munich. So I think the very first thing that we started was like a very classical support vector machine type of classification, you know, bag of words. And it kind of worked for, I think we started with English first. That's actually a good moment to mention that Expertier supports 7 different languages. And if we look at English, it actually, we have to look at it twice because you have US English and British English. And the way that those two countries write their jobs descriptions is completely, completely different. So it took us about a year and a half and hundreds of different iterations, which I will explain exactly what this means. To come to a moment where we said, okay, we are happy with what we have now, so let's focus on quality. We focused on quality. We saw that there are some areas to improve. We saw that there are some opportunities to get more data. And then we said, okay, you know what, so many options. So let's build a real data science department in the company. That's kind of how the whole thing evolved. But the iterations looked a little bit like this. So the agency built the first models. And as I said, we looked at the results. They were not very impressive, I would say. I would say something in the area. So if we take, for example, function, so Expertier has 19 different functions for a job. So stuff like sales, marketing, IT, production, manufacturing. I think in the beginning we had like an F1 score of maybe 45, so maybe 50%, which was not in no way production ready. And we would look at the mistakes, and there were of course the traditional mistakes where you would see that the classifiers were not able to abstract well enough. But there were also other types of mistakes where actually the classifier did the correct job. And then once we looked at the validation, the validated job, we saw that the job was initially classified wrong. And we would then talk to the person that created this job, and we would like try to understand why this mistake happened. And this was like one of the first eye-openers where we found out that people have, you know, humans and stuff, feelings and stuff. So it would, something like this would happen. Like a person would say, hey, you know, that day I remember my girlfriend broke up with me. So I was like in such a bad mood and I wasn't really careful in what I was doing. Right. So you'd have these type of cases. Or we had these quality managers, and they would control the quality of the work, like random samples of people that were a little bit too junior. And there were a few people that were more, you know, they were more careful. So if you were a researcher, that's how we call the people that were classifying the jobs. So if you're a researcher, you know, okay, so today I have person A who is very careful at what he or she does, and tomorrow I have person B. So this kind of impacts the way I also work. So this is, of course, a challenge because it means that the data set that we had to work with was in no way perfect. And we actually had initially the assumption that we have these perfect data sets, which was not the case. So this is kind of an extreme cold shower to begin with.
And so did you go back and kind of clean up all your labels or did you do something else?
Yeah, this was the initial plan to kind of go through the data set, take out the bad stuff. We had this internal hierarchy where we knew if a person was junior or more senior, so we kind of sorted stuff out there. But it still wasn't good enough. So what we did back then was this was kind of the moment where we said, okay, a pure machine learning solution is not going to work out. So maybe let's think if there is a hybrid solution that we can use. So a combination of a classifier, additional features that we would extract from the text. So like pure text analytics. And we would try to enforce the business logic in certain cases where the model fails because the abstraction is too complicated. And in order for people to really understand this, we have to come back at how people like really read jobs. So if you have a traditional job description, right, and I'm trying to guess the career level of this job. So a human would normally start scanning the job description for specific keywords. Like, so if I'm trying to find out if a job is a senior one, I would look for keywords like 4 years of work experience, right? Or 5 years of work experience. But because you have different companies and different languages and different company size and different cultures in the companies, the way they write their description is very heterogeneous. It's very different. So it's really hard to reach an abstraction there. And if one person writes 4 years of work experience, another company would write 2 to 5 years of work experience, or they would write 5 years of relevant work experience. You get the picture. So it's kind of an extreme amount of complexity there when you try to classify these texts. And at this point, we said, okay, let's do a bag of words, let's do 5 grams, see what are the most common combinations of words related to the career level. Career level was very complicated. This was like the most complicated one to classify. And we would then identify these, so to say, key text pieces, and then we would expand them. So that in the end of the day, when you had like an assembled model, with, I don't know if there is a name for it, honestly. So you have a classifier that gives some kind of prediction. Then you would try to additionally see if you have matched some specific semantic structures in the sentences. You would also try to see if you have matched some parts of the text that you extracted in a text analytics part. And you would also compare a classifier on the job title and description separately. And all of this information, it will like go into one big model that will then use support vector machines to do like the final decision of the classification of the job. And this took a lot of iterations. I would say we used to probably do per language, per parameter, more than 100 iterations, which means like 8 languages, 3 main parameters, so 24. And yeah, that's quite a lot. I think you get the picture.
And you mean in terms of training cycles or in terms of just the, you know, versions of the model over time?
Both. So we would clean up the data set where we find inconsistencies. We would retrain the models. Then we would extract some new pieces from the text that are somehow relevant for the text analytic part. The model, we will do some more iterations. We would find out, for example, that specific job categories are not abstracted that well. And there we would do like a very, very hard rule that it's enforced and it has a very high score that goes into the final model.
Interesting. And how long did this process take calendar-wise? Was this, you know, over the course of a couple of years or, you know, much shorter than that?
So English we kind of covered in 3 months. We said that just to get an understanding of what our KPI was. So we said that obviously we cannot get a score of 100%. So we would be very happy if we get something like 55 or 60% of the jobs to be classified at least like 95% correct. So like 60% recall and 90% precision. And in order to get there, it took us about 3 months for English, US and UK, another maybe 4 or 5 months for German, because there was differences in the Swiss German and the German German, and somewhere in beginning of 2016 we were done with French, Spanish, Italian and Dutch. So I would say a year and a half, close to 2 years with the fine tuning afterwards.
And when you look at the kind of the direction that this is all going, do you see, have you started looking at some of the deep learning based NLP models, embeddings and things like that? And do you see that changing your general approach, like taking away the need to do this hierarchical type of model with both the, you know, traditional NLP text analytics stuff and the ML classifiers, or do you expect that you'll always have some degree of that hanging around?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So my hope is that at some point of time, we will be able to completely drop this whole text analytic and business rules part. I mean, it doesn't take that much time to manage them nowadays. We do a lot more retraining, but we started a very So deep learning was such a huge fuss in 2017. So I think in June or July 2017, my team and I decided to kind of explore deep learning for text classification because, like historically speaking, and if you do this whole academic reviews, deep learning was always praised, you know, for text classification. So we tried quite a lot of stuff. So we tried very deep convolutional neural networks, VDCNN. We tried HDL text. So it's like a high hierarchical deep learning. They got to pretty good numbers, I would say, if we look at career level, right? So out of the box, very, very little fine tuning. We got to 80% quite quickly. But what really struck me, it was somehow by chance, one of the people from our team, Viet, he found out about FastText from Facebook. I don't know if you're familiar with this one. Mm-hmm. It's a text classification framework from Facebook, which you can actually train on a pretty normal computer on a desktop. And FastText really blew everything away. We were literally not believing our eyes. So on average, it outperformed all deep learning frameworks we tried by 2, 3, maybe 4%. But the difference in the training time is, you know, for FastText, training on 600,000 jobs, so 6,000 data points, trying to guess 4 classes for career level. FastText takes 2.5 minutes to train on a desktop, and VDCNN takes 16 hours on a 12 gigabyte GPU.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And what about the sample efficiency? Were there any marked differences in the amount of data you needed to provide the different models?
Well, when it comes to data, we kind of decided to go all in because we have millions of hand-classified samples. So really the point was, okay, just try to throw in everything in that we know that it's good and see what comes out.
Okay.
So with regards to this, there were not a lot of problems. There is one specific problem where we are kind of experimenting right now with, I learned something from your show, the zero-shot machine learning. So we have a specific case where we have very few examples present as a data set. So we are kind of playing around with this one. I think there is a very interesting paper from 2017. But yeah, I mean, deep learning was not the cure for us, to be honest. So we decided to stick to fast text.
So the fast text classifier, are you currently using that in production? And how much of all of the other stuff that you had, you know, did it replace or do you see it replacing?
So we do use it in production. It's so as I said, we have this this one model that kind of takes the input from all of the other predictors, and FastText is also one that gives like an additional score there for jobs where we are not sure of how the general classification would perform. And I would really like to like use it completely, but I think that from a risk perspective, I would still like to stick to this kind of ensembled solution that we have for a while, because as I said, we invested a lot of time in creating this whole business logic and text analytic rules. I wouldn't throw them out immediately, but looking at the future, if I'm going to do retrainings, I would definitely focus the energy on the FastText part, because I think that this really works very well for jobs. I don't know what it is exactly. Maybe it's the length of the text. Jobs kind of have on average 2,000 characters, so maybe that's why FastText works very well. Maybe because of the number of features that it can work with. But I think we'll keep the original model for a while still. Yeah, but if I can give a tip to anyone who starts into text classification, it would be to look into FastText. It's really amazing. It's really amazing.
So there was recently a post by it was Jeremy Howard and Seb Gruber talking mm-hmm. about some work that they were doing in applying transfer learning to NLP. I forget what models they use, but have you come across that by any chance?
Yeah, I'm just looking for one of the last papers that I decided to use recently. Yeah, it's called something in the area of structural sentence similarity estimation for short text. I think this is kind of related to transfer learning. And then there was Fast AI. I think they also have...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're probably thinking about the same one.
Jeremy Howard and Sebastian Ruder.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God. Yeah. So once I wrote it, I was like, wow. This is, we gotta try it out. It's in our Jira system. It's prioritized. So the moment the team gets a little bit of air, they're trying it. They're going to try it out, because there is only this graph. It's amazing. It's wow. Yeah.
So it sounds like a big part of your, I don't know if workflow is the right word, but a big part of the way you approach this problem and kind of staying ahead of the curve is tracking the academic research and trying stuff out as you come across stuff that looks interesting.
Yeah, this is absolutely correct. We cannot try to see what comes out in the space. It's really hard to really monitor everything. So I'm just trying to get bits and pieces from everywhere and then try occasionally stuff out that looks promising. I mean, it's really important to kind of see what kind of data sets are used in the papers, because like from my experience, from what I saw in the deep learning part that we did all these tests with, if someone is interested, there is a very long presentation on my LinkedIn profile with all of the tests that we did. So these papers, right, they use the academic papers, they use like very nicely balanced data sets, and they don't necessarily have a touch to reality, like, right? So the way we work is the data sets that we have are like very unbalanced, and they needed a lot of fine tuning. So when I see these benchmarks of the deep learning models to other models in the papers, it looks very promising. But once you try it on your own data, the picture is completely different. So I still try to be like innovative, try stuff out whenever we have time, but we also try to stick to the kind of established things, like FastText, for example.
Is the way you've addressed the imbalanced nature of your data set, is there anything different that you do there beyond the general stuff that we've talked about, the, you know, applying the business rules and things like that?
So for the deep learning part, we tried, of course, oversampling. So we did like tests with and without oversampling. It's especially relevant for specific classifications where, you know, you don't have a lot of jobs in the C-level position, right? So you probably have like 1,000 data points instead of 1 million, which would be in the lower career levels. So the way what we tried out, and it worked out quite well, was to combine classes. Probably there is some term for this in the academic world, but we would kind of keep lower classes where we had a lot of data points in one classifier, right? So you'll have class one, class two, class three, and then class four would be a combined of the classes where we had very little data. So this classifier would do like the first decision, you know, is it one, two, three, or four? And four could be then, class four could be then additional three more classes. And there, for example, we find out that FastText really captured very well this differentiation on the high classes that the deep learning model did not abstract, was not able to abstract. Hmm. So this is kind of my experience on the imbalanced data sets.
Very cool. Any other experiences that you'd like to share?
Oh, yeah. So for people that are kind of rolling out machine learning services in the organization, I have a few tips. So first of all, as I said, you know, do some big and bold goals, like double something or triple something, so that you can kind of try to challenge the status quo that you have in your organization. But at the same time, you have to be, of course, able to balance by not setting the project scope too large. Because if you set the project scope too large, then you have a lot of unknown factors, and you would have a too optimistic roadmap. And especially if you learn work in a large company, you know, politics can be kind of a bummer for data scientists, because you tend to overpromise. Then once you are kind of ready to roll out your solution, my suggestion would be to kind of identify the people in your team that are the very, you know, motivated, curious people that are interested in trying new stuff out, and first play it out with them a little bit, and after that roll it out to the whole organization. So I would use this kind of small core team to improve the solution as much as I can. And I would then roll it out into the whole organization, because people are generally very skeptic by nature. We had this kind of experience. So you give this amazing solution, right? And the person sees that it kind of automates his or her jobs, or it helps him or her a lot. And the first thing that they try to find out is why it cannot work, or why or how it is wrong, right? So they don't focus on kind of improving the solution, but they kind of focus on how to convince you that this is never going to work out. And this was a big fight in the organization. So this was a very kind of an interesting experience. And be careful with this, like, first implementations, because if you kind of fail there, then you're going to have the general team will have some kind of skepsis for the whole project, and it's hard to get away from it. So my suggestion would be to rather release something once you're like very sure that it's working well, instead of kind of releasing too early and not being good enough. And with regards to if you're like starting with machine learning, the cloud providers, from my perspective, are great. So these are industry leaders, and we see this kind of trend of having off-the-shelf solutions for machine learning. So from my perspective, this is going to be the future. And I talk a lot about it when I'm at conferences, and people tend to not believe me, but I think that in a few years, we are going to have a lot more solutions like drag and drop your data, and we'll figure it out for you. And here's an API, you know, and just, you know, send us everything that you want on this API and we'll give you back the result. Mm-hmm. This is the way I think data science at all is developing.
Well, Alex, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Yeah, thank you, Sam.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. For more information on Alexander or any of the topics covered in this episode, head over to twimlai.com/talk/161. If you didn't hit pause and nominate us for the Podcast People's Choice Awards at the beginning of the show, I'd like to encourage you to jump over to twimlai.com/nominate right now and send us your love and your vote. As always, thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.